For truth, for the nobles. I don't know if you say like this, for your Aryas. An Arya being is somebody who has a direct perception of emptiness, who is on the path of seeing. Yeah, like we might have a very vague understanding what it means, this whole thing about emptiness, that things don't exist the way that they appear. Yeah, they exist, but not the way that they appear. They're empty of inherent existence. So we might have a very vague idea what that means. Empty, by the way, you have to be very, very careful. Empty does not mean non-existent. Yeah, don't kind of fall into that trap. You know, you think you made it all and you understand it all, and you go, yeah, who cares? Everything's empty. It's not like this, yeah, at all, actually. It's when you understand emptiness, then you start to see how serious this is, and then you can do something about this. If you don't understand about emptiness, then very, very difficult. So then one thinks about this again and again and again and again, and then one meditates on this again and again and again and again, so that the delusions that we have, that things do exist the way that they appear to us, becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. This is just talking in a very gross way. Delusions can't become thinner and thinner and thinner. I'm talking about delusions as if they're something material. They're not something material. But anyway, they get loosened up. You know, it's like habits. Let's say, maybe we can relate to that, a habit. Yeah, when you really make a decision, you want to kick that habit. Sorry, not a good word. You want to get rid of that habit. You want to eliminate that habit. Then, you know, it's a lot of effort at the beginning, and falling back is very, very, very easy. But then again, you give yourselves the reasons why you want to give up that habit again and again and again and again. You only think about the shortcomings of having this habit. This is how we use the thought process in order to help the mind to kind of to lessen that desire and the habit, and then slowly, 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 you know, then it's from being very difficult, it becomes more easy, and then all of a sudden it is gone. But it's a gradual process, yeah. And just, you know, so this is why what we do actually in Buddhism, we take the mind thought process to help, like for example with the habit. It's not enough just to say, oh, I want to stop doing this. It's not enough. You have to give the mind reasons why you want to stop this habit. And in order to give the mind the good reasons, so that it's easier to let go and then easier to say no, you have to think about the shortcomings of having this habit again and again and again and again and again and again and again. See, if you want to quit smoking and you constantly think that then you will eat sweets and they will make you fat, then you're not helping your mind to give up the habit. Whereas if you go and look after people who have lung cancer, that might help. Yeah, that is much more effective like this. So one learns in this kind of spiritual practice that we do, one learns to think to look at in one way. Because there is no real one way looking or one way thinking. Because we have a very dualistic mind. There's nothing that is 100% bad, just bad. There's nothing that is 100% good, just good. Right? There is always something negative in it. So we have to then use some intelligence or wisdom that we have to see, okay, so what do I want to attain? What do I want to achieve? And how do I want to think so that it helps the mind to go into that direction, and then it becomes automatically. Yeah? So like this. I don't know if you can relate to them. How many of you have smoked and are not smoking anymore? Good. Me also. So, was it easy at the beginning? Yeah, the habit, you know, this kind of, it comes automatic, and then you need to apply some effort, and then slowly, slowly. Now it's like you wake up in the morning, I guess you're not longing for a cigarette or after a meal. I don't have any wish to smoke anymore at all. I think only once in a dream I was smoking, and I thought, what are you doing in my dream? That's stupid, what are you doing? I wasn't even enjoying it, I was just smoking. So like this, so we learn how to think, you know, in a way so that it helps the mind to go where we want to go. And then we need to know where we want to go, and we need to know what kind of thought process to apply. But the thought, as I said yesterday, the thought process is not enough. Then we have to think about this again and again, 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 until it's finally there. And for that, we need to have patience and diligence. We need to make effort. None of it comes easy. Yeah. But if we really want the result, then all this will be able to do. So this is why very important at the beginning of whatever you do, you know, you need to have an aspiration. You need to really want it now. So you can say, is that not desire? Yes, it is desire, but we have desire anyway. So then at least let's desire something positive instead of just following the desires for things that are not making us happy. Yeah. So of course, the whole thing is one goes beyond kind of all this wanting, not wanting, you know. But at the beginning, that an aspiration, wanting to liberate oneself from suffering. I mean, this is what needs to be there, because otherwise, you know, or this whole path becomes completely meaningless. Yeah. So somebody who is a noble, the noble truth, somebody who's a noble being, somebody who's an Arya, is somebody who has understood, has seen through the delusions, seeing how the delusions project reality outside directly. You know, that is like somebody who, you know, when you walk in the dusk, like here also there's some snakes. So when you go and it's a little bit dark, you know, and then you go on this white path there, and then you see something coiled on the path, and you go, snake, right? So that's us, not even looking, not even checking if it's true. And then is all the fear and you run away, or if you would have something to spray to kill it, you would probably immediately spray it to kill it and whatever. Now, if you use your wisdom, you know, wisdom would be a torch. You shine your torch on that thing, and then you see, it's just a snake, it's just a rope, you know. And then all those afflictive emotions, all the negative emotions against that thing completely goes, because you understand that the rope is not dangerous. So the one who has seen that this is just a rope would be an Arya being, a noble being. He understands, you know, that this is not as it appears. Still something appears to him or to her. Yeah, so it's not a fully enlightened Buddha. They still have to then work on their mind to then the habits of the delusions to eliminate those. Still, for somebody who is a noble being, somebody who's on the path of seeing, this is true. For us, it's kind of, we, you know, intellectually again, we say, yeah, but the way we behave is not like this. We're still jumping every time we see that rope. Although maybe intellectually we know that this is just a rope, it's not a snake. But the habit is so strong. To see it as a snake, to see pleasant things as pleasurable and as happiness, it is so strong, yeah. And to blame things outside, it is so strong that every time we see that rope, we jump and we think it's a snake. And then we need thought process. Actually, it's just a rope. It's not a snake. Yeah. Now, this whole thing, truth for an Arya. An Arya being, like somebody like this, somebody who's on the path of seeing, somebody who sees emptiness directly, actually, you know, it's debatable whether he would really, he doesn't see those Four Noble Truths. Why not? Maybe somebody who studied. What do you see in your meditation on the path of seeing? Only the third Noble Truth, right? Only cessation. The other three are conventional truth. So an Arya being doesn't really see those Four Noble Truths directly, because you cannot, because they're conventional truth. So when an Arya being is in meditation and nothing appears to his mind or her mind, it's not just that men can be Arya beings, those are women, then the only thing that Arya being would perceive is cessation, the third Noble Truth, a complete cessation of all appearances. You know, but then when they come out of meditation, then the things again appears, but then they know it's an illusion. Then they know that it's just an illusion. Yeah. Okay. So just for the title here. So I think maybe this is why many people just keep this title, The Four Noble Truths, because otherwise you would have to give that explanation, you know, truth for the nobles, what does it mean? Now, so three of those truths are not really true. They're just conventional truths. And this is what makes Buddhism incredibly difficult, because our mind is very used to black and white. This is good and this is bad. And that's it. Yeah. Whereas Buddhism, nothing is like this. Yeah. So then we need to know when we discuss something, whether we discuss conventional truths or whether we discuss ultimate truths. You know, on a conventional level, good is good and bad is bad. But on an ultimate level, there is no such thing as good and bad. But our mind is very conventional and relative. So this is why that's what we have to work with. But if we get stuck in there and we want to eliminate the bad things in order to have the good things, we are stuck. Because it's not possible. Because in relative truth, everything depends on each other. So you cannot have good things if you don't have any bad things. Okay? You know, we would like to eliminate all the things we dislike so that we only have the things we like. It's impossible. If you like things, you need to things that you dislike. Otherwise, how can you like things? Or the other two extremes that we kind of think, you know, we only know existence or non-existence. They're completely dependent on each other. You can only have existence because you also have non-existence. You can only have non-existence because you also have existence. You can't have non-existence without existence. Something that is real and something that is fake is completely dependent on each other. You can't have anything that is real if you don't have anything that is fake. Because what makes it real is that it's not fake. But we're not used to think like this. For us, it's like it's either this or that, and this can be without this. Yeah. So this is why then the Buddha gave three big teachings, or three major teachings. They're called the three turnings of the wheel. So this one of the Four Noble Truths, that is the first one. So the way he talks is very black and white. Now here, right? True sufferings, first noble truth. Second noble truth, true origins. Third noble truth, true cessations. Fourth noble truth, true path. Right? Very solid. Then, the second turning of the wheel that he gave, which was in Rajgir, this was in Sarnath, which is near Varanasi, if anybody's been to India. It's about 11 kilometers from Varanasi or Benares. You can go visit this place where the Buddha gave the first teaching. Yeah, after he had attained enlightenment. This is the first teaching that he gave. Then a little bit further down the line, a little bit later, he gave the second turning of the wheel, which goes into the... So out of this teaching, most of the Theravadin schools came, right? Then the Mahayana schools, of which Tibetan Buddhism goes into that category, came from the second and the third turning of the wheel. So there, he especially, you know, kind of taught on wisdom, the wisdom side, and especially on emptiness. So out of that, we still have this very nice, the wonderful sutra, which is very short, which is called the Heart of Wisdom, or the Perfection of Wisdom, Heart of Wisdom Sutra. So in there, and actually you have it in this little booklet. So in there, he says exactly the opposite. He says, there is no suffering. There is no cause. There is no cessation. There is no path. So, you know, I mean, one really has to think, what is this guy? Come on. First he says, true suffering, true origin, true cessation, true path. And then a little bit somewhere else he says exactly the opposite. There is no suffering. There is no origin. There is no cessation. There is no path. Now, then he gave the third turning of the wheel in order to explain why, you know, this comes from those two different sides. So the first turning of the wheel has to do, of course, with conventional truth. Then second turning of the wheel, he really explains that if you do believe in suffering as real and as true, then you will not be able to liberate yourself from it. Yeah. But if he starts by saying there is no suffering, there is no origin, there is no cessation, there is no path, then people would just go, okay, then let's just sit and have a good time, right? So this is why he started like this. So people's mind would become more refined by seeing the origin of the suffering, and then work with that, which is our delusions. Yeah. Also, so that people would have, you know, if you perceive unhappiness, suffering, right? Unsatisfaction, things like that. And then somebody comes and says, bah, you're just imagining it. Would that really help you? You think? As a psychologist, you know, if you're a psychologist, you know that the person is psychotic. You know that what the person's mind perceives is not there. If you're a good psychologist, you just tell the person, yeah, no, you don't worry, you're just crazy. It's just your mind projecting that nothing is there. Would you treat the person like this? Would you? For those who are psychologists. Never. Is it? You have to go into the person's world to be able to help the person untangle it. Now, there's a very good example about this. You know, if it would be very smart, actually it would be enough, the Buddha telling us, there is no suffering. You're just imagining this. If there is no real suffering, there can also be no true origins. Therefore, there cannot be true cessations. Therefore, there cannot be true path. Yeah. So if we're really smart, we would be able to let go just like that. But we're not. So this is why we have all this other stuff here around us to help us to refine our mind to the state where it becomes much more clearer, and then where we can see through the illusion. Yeah. So Tsongsa Khinzen in particular gives a very good example. He says, if you're smart and you have you're psychotic and you see like 50 elephants in your room and you're really frightened, and then somebody comes and says, hey, look, how many, and you're not just saying the elephants are not there, so you're using logic, you know, suffering appears, but, yeah, so those elephants, they appear, but, so then the person would say, how many elephants can fit into your room? Or how many elephants can go through your door? So then if the person is really smart, he understands they appear, but they're not there. Yeah. So it doesn't mean that there is no suffering. It doesn't mean like that. It appears that there is. But when you look for it, it's not there. Okay, or it still appears, but it can't be there. Like the elephants, they would still appear, but you understand. Something in your mind starts to understand, can't be. So you need logic. Just saying it's not there, this is not helping anybody. Yeah. Then, but so for somebody who's not smart and couldn't be logic like this, then we have to agree with the person and say, yes, there is elephants in your room. Let's do something about them. And you start to make noise and you build a fire and you make the door bigger or whatever for those elephants to leave, and then they go. Why can they go? Because they didn't exist in the first place. Yeah. Mind is so tricky. The mind is so tricky. And the problem is that we think we're sane. Yeah. We're just as psychotic as any other person. We have just as many projections as any other person who is kind of certified crazy. We're just as crazy. So don't worry if you think you're not completely sane, then it's actually you're one step further than people who think they're completely sane. So it's good. Okay, good. So maybe we just, before we start, we take refuge, or maybe we can. Maybe we do recite the Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. That would be a good thing to start with. Just for auspiciousness' sake, then you don't need to understand. Just let go, you know. Anyway, this whole course, you know, it's 2 days, or maybe 1 3-quarter days, is very profound, especially for the ones who are here for the first time. If you really get interested in how to liberate yourself from your suffering, a 1 3-quarter day course is not enough. So whatever you don't understand now, if you are interested, you will have to come to more teachings and read books and discussions and more teachings. So whatever you don't understand, just let it go. It's okay. It's no problem, you know. You will not be, I will not be able to give you everything in these 2 days and then you can go off and practice on your own. It's impossible. Yeah. So just let go. Just relax. Whatever you understand, you understand. Whatever you don't understand. And then also if it doesn't, if you think, no, this is not something I want to do, and then you never think about those things anymore, then why do you need to understand? There's no point. So relax. It's okay. The more your mind is relaxed, the more you understand, by the way. The more you want to grasp at things and you need to get it now, the more you get tense, and then the more you can't understand. We really allow, when the mind is relaxed, you allow the mind to get things on a different level almost than this, you know, I want to understand. Okay? So it's difficult. It's difficult for the ego, but it's okay, you know. And also you'll see, as you keep going to the teachings, you will understand in different ways, yeah. You come out of here, and especially beginners, because this is, on the surface, is very simple teachings. And especially beginners say, yes, I know that. I didn't need the Buddha to tell me that, yeah. Then when you start practicing, you see how we think we know, but we don't really know. Yeah, and then you start to see the subtle points, and then you start to appreciate, you know. This is why also an Arya being who has seen the delusions appreciates the Four Noble Truths so much, because they see how true this is, how true our projections seem to be, like, kind of thing. Okay. So the praise to Shakyamuni Buddha, this also we can do as just, you know, we have, these are the direct teachings who come from the Buddha. It's not a commentary on something. It's the words of the Buddha. So maybe we can just say the praise out of appreciation to the Guru, Founder, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arhat, Perfectly Completed Buddha, Glorious Conqueror, Shakyamuni Buddha. I prostrate, make offerings and go for refuge. Please grant me your blessings. To the Guru, Founder, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arhat, Perfectly Completed Buddha, Glorious Conqueror, Shakyamuni Buddha, I prostrate, make offerings and go for refuge. Please grant me your blessings. To the Guru, Founder, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arhat, Perfectly Completed Buddha, Glorious Conqueror, Shakyamuni Buddha, I prostrate, make offerings and go for refuge. Please grant me your blessings. Grant me your blessings means, please make my mind open so that I can understand teachings. Not just understand intellectually. You see, our mind is a little bit like a stone that you put into water. Even if it's there for 20 years, the surface gets wet, but that's it. The moment you take the stone out of the water, you put it in the sun, it's all dry again. Yeah. So we want our mind to become like a sponge that absorbs the teachings. This is why we ask for blessings like this. So we can transform the mind. We can, you know, we can really do something with this. Not just say, yeah, 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 I believe it, this is true, it's very nice, and then go home and do the same old thing. Yeah. It's okay. So then the heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time, the Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgriha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattvari Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the Pram Perfection of Wisdom, beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvadiputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So now this is the main part here. Yeah, this is the whole path, just this paragraph that comes now. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristics, unproduced, unseized, stainless, not without stains, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no composition of factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, now this is the one, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and now very important, and also no non-attainment. Otherwise you fall into nihilism, right? There is no attainment, but also no non-attainment. Understanding that there is no attainment is the attainment. But you need to include that. There is no attainment and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscurations and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to the unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering should be known as the truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Tayata Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Soha. So what it means is like gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond enlightenment, so be it. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should train into profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that, one should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated, even the Tathagatas rejoice. Then the Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvadiputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Aryavalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. Then we take refuge. So on the next page, in the middle, we can do once in English, twice in Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the accumulations of generosity and so forth, may I become Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodan soki chonam la chanchu badu dani kyapsu chi tagi chin soki pesanangi chola penchi sangye chupasho. Then the four immeasurables, that really sets the mind into the right direction. Why we are doing this? We're doing this so that may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings never be separated from happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from desire for friends and hatred for enemies. Then the seven limb prayer, we do this in order to purify negativities, to create some merit, and then we will be able to understand and we will be able to practice. This is like, if you want to have a good crop, you need to prepare the earth where you put the seeds in. So you take all the stones out, you make it wet, and like this. This is the seven limb prayer. We prepare the mind to be able to receive those teachings so that we can receive them in the right way and they can bring a good crop. So it's a very skillful way of, working with the mind. Usually we just clonk down on our cushion and then we want to attain enlightenment just like this. We don't really prepare. So we're like somebody who takes a handful of seeds and just throws it out there hoping that something will grow. That's very unskillful. Something might grow, but we don't know what. So we're not prepared. So all this is just to prepare the mind. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offerings, actual and imagined. I confess all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the virtuous actions of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So for those who have a guru, then you can visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, space in front of you. Shakyamuni Buddha is your guru. Now, if you don't feel comfortable with this, then just leave it. This is just, we do this in general. We ask again for inspiration. We ask for blessings. So in order to be able to understand, in order to be able to practice, so we ask, glorious and precious root guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, through the entire line of spiritual masters, I make requests. So just briefly, we think, you know, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, these teachings have been upheld, they have been practiced, people have attained realizations. So it's thanks to those people who have attained realizations, the teachings are still very much alive. So we just spend 1 minute thinking like that. Again, gratitude, appreciation. And we make requests to join that lineage of the fortunate ones seeking liberation. And then if you feel comfortable, Shakyamuni Buddha absorbs into you. Okay. So if you would be a practicing Buddhist, Mahayana Buddhist, what we just did in 3 minutes, you can spend a whole hour on that. And then you start the meditation. And then it works. Then the garden is prepared. You know, when we're always very surprised that our mind is so stiff in the meditation. It doesn't really want to go where you want it to go. It's because we don't prepare. If I throw a handful of seeds outside there and the next year I come and nothing is there, and I complain, and then somebody says, did you water it? Did you take the stones out? I said, no, I just threw them. Then the person says, well, you know, what do you expect? Okay. Now there's a few more terms that we need to discuss before we start. The term samsara and the term nirvana and the term of the five contaminated aggregates. So, samsara and nirvana. So this is two opposites, one thinks. Again, samsara is dependent on nirvana, nirvana is dependent on samsara. They are not places. We're not going somewhere, right? It's not when you are in samsara. Samsara is this cyclic existence that we are reborn again and again and again and again and again and again and again, whether we want or not, because you can't destroy the mind, because mind is not matter. And as long as we have this craving for existence, then the mind will go after death and find another body, because we want to exist. Yeah, this is our instinct, it's a craving, it's a desire for existence. So we'll go and find another body, reincarnation. But because we are reincarnated out of like the main force that makes us reincarnate is desire for our own happiness, or, you know, just for our own sake, just for the sake of existing, then that is defiled, and then this is why it creates the suffering. This is why we never find what we really want. So we struggle and we struggle and we struggle in order to get rid of the suffering. But we are just looking at the symptoms. We want to get rid of the symptoms, but we don't want to get rid of the causes for the symptoms. We're stuck in the symptoms. We work with the symptoms and we don't want to get rid of the causes. And then, you know, so this is why samsara kind of perpetuates itself. So samsara, this cycle of existence, does not stop by itself. Like there's not you don't have a certain number of lifetimes and then it's finished. Yeah. As long as this craving for existence is there, you will be reborn again and again and again and again. For those who were not here last night, this is what Buddhism says. If you don't believe it, it's fine with me. I don't mind at all. Yeah, it's really, that's what Buddhism says. And I have to tell you that because this is about Four Noble Truths. Yeah. Now, samsara has causes. You know, the cycle of suffering existence, and we come to what the Buddha means by suffering. So the cycle of existences that are pervaded with sufferings has causes. If it wouldn't have causes, if it would be natural, if it would be in the nature of things that we do have those things, then there's no point to discuss it. Then we just, you know, settle with it and say, well, that's the way it is, there's nothing I can do, and that's it. But we discuss this in length. Why? Because it's completely unnecessary. Why is it completely unnecessary? Because it's based on illusion. It's based on ignorance. It's based on misconceptions. So, you know, we said yesterday the word Buddha means awake. So we are like somebody, we're in a very bad nightmare and we refuse to wake up. And all we need to do is wake up. And the enemy is gone. The one who's running after you, the one who's about to kill you is gone, disappeared. But we refuse to wake up. Why? Because we cling to our dream as this being real. Buddha, he's awake. He sees. He still sees dreams, but he knows that those are dreams. Okay? So that's samsara. So it's not a place. You know, it's not that Tuval is nirvana and Carmel is samsara. Or like, say, Jerusalem maybe is nirvana and Tel Aviv, because it's so hedonistic, is samsara. It's not like that. Yeah, it's a state of mind. Samsara is when you have the five contaminated aggregates. And when you study Buddhism, you hear about those five heaps or five aggregates, like a lot. Have they been translated into Hebrew, the word aggregates? Did you hear? Parts, heaps, you know. Things like that. Now, what are they? I should have included them into there, but I didn't. But anyway, so form. The five aggregates. This is you. Yeah, you're nothing but five aggregates. So don't be so think you're so special. We're all the same. We're all a heap, five heaps, right? So form, body, everything that is solid, everything that is matter. So this is physical. So one of the five aggregates is physical. The other four are psychological, mental, feelings. It's the second aggregate. Discrimination or perception. It's the third. Compositional factors is the fourth. And consciousness is the fifth. This is what a person is. Not just a person as a human being, but also an animal. Animals also have a form. They have feelings. They have perceptions. You know, they can discriminate. They know differences. They have emotions. So compositional factors, you could call them emotions, like the other mental factors, because we have many of them. And they have a consciousness. So animals are also persons, not just humans. Animals also have five contaminated aggregates. Okay? Why are they contaminated? Because we see them as, we project too much reality onto them. Yeah? We think that this is me, this is I. We talk about this when we talk about the wrong views, mistaking there's a real I there that owns those five contaminated aggregates, for example. Or projecting a permanent I into those five contaminated aggregates that are completely transient, they're changing all the time. Yeah? Like that. So this is what we are. Why are they contaminated? Because they are appropriated through desire, attachment. You know, when we die, we go and grab them again, because that's what a person is. That's why they are contaminated, because they don't come from pure causes. And this is why they're in the nature of suffering. Okay. So having those five appropriated, like we get them, nobody throws them on us. So having those five contaminated aggregates, that is samsara. Because no matter how you turn, you will encounter suffering of whatever kind. We come to that. Nirvana is to be free of those five contaminated aggregates. Meaning you have eliminated the causes to appropriate those five contaminated aggregates, which are our negative emotions, our afflictive emotions. That is nirvana. A mind who doesn't have any ignorance, any desire, any attachment, any miserliness, any pride, any doubt, fear, anything that is negative, completely eliminated, uprooted, not there anymore. Especially this root illusion of thinking that there's a separate I who owns this body and this mind. That is gone. That is nirvana. So you have different nirvanas. Yeah. So you have nirvana, what is called nirvana with remainder. That means in this contaminated body that is still in the nature of suffering and still dies or gets sick, your mind has abandoned all the delusions. So this body still dies. But then the mind doesn't take on a new body, and then you get what is called nirvana without remainder. So your mind would go into a very peaceful state. When you ask me what it is, can't say, it's beyond conceptions. We can't imagine. Yeah. So that would be the goal. There's two vehicles, right? So that would be the goal of the Theravadin tradition. You work for your own liberation. You want to get out of samsara. And this is what most of the people practiced at the time of the Buddha. Because they were ready to hear those teachings, that your suffering is not necessary, you can eliminate it, this is what you do, and then you will be liberated. And this is the Theravadin teachings. And please, you know, even if you are a Mahayanist, never look down on people who only practice Theravadin, because they're so selfish, they're only looking for their own liberation. Yeah, it's very difficult to look for your own liberation. And why not? You know, somebody says, okay, I want to get out of here and I don't think I have the capacity to help others to get out. It's good enough. Because then at least the world is rid of you. You don't eat anymore. You don't harm anybody. You don't pollute, you know. One being less in this world. Yes. Exactly. So it's very good. It's very good. So, you know, I mean, this is what most of the people practiced at the time of the Buddha. Now, I wouldn't call it arrogance, by the way. But then to some lesser, you know, to less people, not so many people who were ready for this, you know, people who were ready to hear that actually you can attain full enlightenment, and then you have the skills to liberate others. You have many more skills, and so you shouldn't just go into nirvana and then just stay there. You should then appropriate bodies that can be of benefit to others and then come back again and again and again and again and again, and again until everybody else is liberated. So that's a different goal. So fewer people practiced that at the time of the Buddha, and even fewer people practiced Tantra at the time of the Buddha, because you have to be really ready in order to be able to practice Tantra. Yeah. So out of this, different vehicles come. And actually, after the Buddha, Theravadin and Mahayana, it was practiced together. It wasn't kind of a split like this. You know, in Nalanda Monastery, some people were Mahayanas, some people were Theravadins, because after a while, with the Theravadin vehicle, it became very elitist, actually, and very cold and very intellectual only. So this is why then the compassion part kind of came in, and they started to make this more public. Like the Mahayana teachings only became public 500 years after the Buddha passed on. This is why many people say, oh, it's not the words of the Buddha. Yeah, because it wasn't practiced for actually quite a long time. This goal, not just my own liberation, but I want to continue to practice in order to then be able to benefit all sentient beings. I am not going into eternal peace. I want to work further. So this, you need quite a lot of courage to do that, actually. So not everybody was ready for that. I don't think it's arrogance, quite honestly. Yeah. Oh, okay. So the confidence, maybe that would be a good word. Not everybody has the confidence to bear, you know, the sufferings in samsara for so much longer until everybody is liberated. Yeah. Now, if you want to get rid of your own suffering, you have to be able to bear suffering, by the way. You know, because the spiritual path is difficult. You have to be able to bear giving up, running away every time it gets difficult, running towards pleasures, running towards mummy, going to sleep, taking pills, whatever. You have to be able to face the suffering. You have to be able to, in order to transcend it, you have to look at it. You have to bear it. Otherwise, you cannot transcend it. Otherwise, you're just running away. And then suffering defeats you again and again and again and again and again. Every time you turn your back on suffering and you try to escape, next time suffering has more power on you. If you can confront it and really acknowledge it, it has much less power over you because you lose your fear of it. Yeah. So although we do want to kind of get rid of suffering, you really have to bear it. Now, bearing the suffering as a Mahayanist, to postpone, you don't really postpone your enlightenment. This is the old text that they say a bodhisattva postpones his own enlightenment. He postpones his nirvana without remainder. That's what he postpones. He doesn't go into peace. He manifests again and again and again and again and again as an enlightened being to benefit others in whatever form is of benefit. You know, that can be a sick dog. So we can generate compassion, for example. A Buddha can manifest as whatever, many, many different forms. We can't, you know, we're one person. If three people come and say, I want to talk to you, I have problems, and I only have 1 hour, I'm completely overwhelmed. I don't know whom to take first and what to do and this and that. And then I listen for a very short time and then, you know, I don't help either one. If I would be a Buddha, I can manifest three forms and we go with each one. I go to another part and that's it. So it's much easier to be a Buddha. Also, you have the wisdom, you know, the wisdom to help. We waste so much energy to be uncertain how to really help because we don't know. Yeah. So then that nirvana of such a person would be called non-abiding nirvana. So the mind is in the nirvana, but the body takes on a suffering body. You know, this is why they say the Dalai Lama is a Buddha. He has a human body that gets sick and that will die and is getting old. And you can see how he hobbles when he gets up from walking. Actually, he still sits like 2-3 hours sometimes, not moving his legs, nothing, cross-legged, you know. He's 72 years old. So, yeah. So this is about, you can see he has pain, yeah? Like, so as a Buddha, you would endure this pain because why? Because there is some benefit, there is some purpose, you know? So a Buddha would feel, a Buddha cannot just sit somewhere and have fun and be blissful when they see other beings are suffering. So this is the Mahayana goal, because your own happiness becomes a little bit tasteless when you see that so many other beings are still suffering and you would have the skills to be able to do something with them. I mean, not the ones who are unruly. You know, even the Buddha says, the ones who are unruly, the ones who don't believe, the ones who don't want to be liberated, he says, leave them. What can you do? Don't force anybody. Don't go on a mission. You know, not even a Buddha goes on a mission. The Buddha, when he taught those teachings, he said, look, this is what I have found. This is what I have observed. Now, if you think this is logic, you can do something with this, then I'm quite ready to help you and to explain to you. If you think it's not true and you think you have something better, or even you don't have anything better, but you think there is nothing to do, then that's fine. So not everybody became a Buddhist at the time of the Buddha. He didn't go on a mission converting everybody to Buddhism. It's not like that at all. You know, this is why I said yesterday, you can't really be born as a Buddhist, because that would be like, you know, converting. Like you just, okay, now I'm, yesterday I wasn't a Buddhist, now I'm a Buddhist. You only become a Buddhist when you accept the four seals, the four pillars of Buddhism. And this, you know, sometimes I even ask myself, am I really accepting this? So what are they? This is also good to know. They are, all compounded things are impermanent. That means everything that comes together through causes will fall apart at one point. All contaminated things, and all contaminated things, that means everything that comes through delusion, through ignorance, is in the nature of suffering. The Buddha didn't say everything is suffering. All contaminated things are in the nature of suffering. That means all our emotions. And that is very difficult to accept. Like even our ordinary human beings, love, compassion, all these, even that is in the nature of suffering. Because it's contaminated. It's mixed with ignorance. Thinking that the suffering is real. There's a real I that has real suffering. Or when you look at somebody else, you know, there's a real me, I, who is helping, you know, a real act of helping to somebody real other than me. Yeah, this is why they're contaminated in the nature of suffering. That's very difficult to accept. Do we really accept this, you know? So as long as we have ignorance, all our emotions are in the nature of suffering. Difficult. We would like to get rid of anger and attachment, and we want to have love and compassion. But as long as we don't get rid of ignorance, we will have contaminated love and compassion. It's better than having hate and greed, that is true. But it's still in the nature of suffering. It will lead to suffering. Okay, then the third one, there is no separate self. He doesn't say there is no self. You have to listen very, very carefully when you listen to the Buddha's teachings. He didn't say there is no self. He said there is no separate self. We'll come to that this afternoon and tomorrow. And then only nirvana is peace. So that doesn't mean, again, doesn't mean nirvana is a place that here is not peaceful, so you have to go to Switzerland. Not like that, you know. Nirvana is a mind state. You will only have the happiness that you want, this pure, lasting happiness, when you have eliminated all the causes for the suffering, which means our negative, afflictive emotions. Only then. That is nirvana. Only that is peace, nothing else. We have occasional peace. I'm not saying that we don't have any peace. We have occasional happinesses, but they all end. And then again, we have to go search, right? So if you accept that, then you are a Buddhist. Those are the four pillars of Buddhism. Then you would take refuge, meaning you know that the Buddhist path can lead you out of this suffering. So you have faith and trust. You don't know, you know. If you want to know whether there is enlightenment before you embark on the path, you will never embark on the path. I don't know if there is enlightenment, but I believe it. And I can also see, what can I lose if I believe in the potential to become a pure being? And I know that I have to start with stopping to harm others. What can I lose? I can only gain working with my delusions, you know. Even it is not possible to get rid of all my delusions. But if I believe it, I continue to work on it. And as we said yesterday, then they become more and more and more and more and more subtle. At one point, they will be gone. Maybe not, I don't know. But I can see that as I get along on the path, when the delusions become more and more and more subtle, already now I have some kind of happiness. It's not lasting happiness, but it's just some kind of happiness. The same way, if you want to become a millionaire and you want to go from zero to a million, just like this, you'll never become a millionaire. You have to go step by step. So even though after a while you are not a millionaire, but you're richer, Yeah, so it's like that. That's why we have a path. It's a gradual, you know, eliminating the delusions. It doesn't just go boom and that's it. So it's a long path. I talk about eons and eons and eons of lifetimes. So arhatship, like self-liberation, is much shorter. It's much, much shorter. Okay. Is that more or less maybe clear? The five aggregates, this is what we are. This is samsara. We have to liberate ourselves from them. And then we'll be in nirvana. And what makes you a Buddhist is to accept those four pillars or the four seals. So you check up, you know, when you take refuge in the morning. Where's your mind? What is it planning? Is it really planning liberation and enlightenment, or is it planning how to find a good meal for lunch, thinking that this will make us happy? I know where my mind is. It's definitely more in the meals than in the enlightenment. Although I say the words, you know. So this is what I'm saying. I mean, it's a very, if somebody would say, are you a Buddhist? Of course I would say yes, but deep down I say, I wonder. I really wonder. But the moment you really accept those four seals, then you're really on the path. And then it goes, I think, quite fast. So, and then also, once you're on the path, even if it doesn't go fast, it doesn't matter. But as long as we're not on the path yet, as long as we still cling to things as being pleasant and pleasant being happiness, then the path seems incredibly long and incredibly heavy and incredibly difficult. I think it's a little bit like this, you know. If you are sick and you are convinced that there is a cure, even this cure is very difficult and is much more painful than your sickness, actually. You know, there is cures that are more painful than the sickness itself, cancer. But you undergo those hardships. This is why I said, if you want to liberate yourself from suffering, you have to be able to bear suffering. If you want to get rid of your cancer, you have to bear the sufferings of radiation and chemotherapy for the moment. Why can you bear it? Because you know that you are sick. You know that this cancer is not one with your body. You know that you can be free from that cancer. You know, you don't know if it will happen in this life. This you don't know. You know, maybe yes, you know. But and if you have no trust, you will not bear the hardships. No way. There we have trust. We have to die anyway, see? This is the thing, you know, cancer, no cancer, everybody dies. But then that we can liberate our mind from all delusions, this we don't trust. It's quite strange, actually, you know. Because here, what we're talking here is like, once you have liberated your mind, this is a one-time job. Once you have liberated your mind from delusions, that's it. They can't come back. They cannot come back. Whereas you rid yourself of your cancer, it can come back. If not in this life, another life, if you're human again. It's all like that. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't go into chemotherapy. I'm just telling you, if you are going into chemotherapy in case you have cancer, you need to have this mind, you know. And don't go, this is poison for my body, when the things go into your body. Really see it as medicine. Then maybe it creates a bit less damage. Yeah. And the mind is very, very powerful. The more you trust that this will work, yeah, the more you allow it to work. But still, with this thing, kind of, if it doesn't work, then you know it was no, you know, the conditions were not right, the causes were not right, something was not right. Yeah. Trust, now this is very tricky, you know. Trust that it will work has to be based on also logic reasoning. Yeah. Like this thing that we can rid ourselves, we can rid our mind from all delusions, we can see that sometimes the mind is free of delusions. And then we see that we feel good. So then we can start to believe, oh, this is my nature. You know, somebody asked Boka Rinpoche at one point. He said, yeah, but people, it's so much easier to be negative than to be loving and compassionate and positive, patient and all that. That what we call the positive emotions. How do you know that the positive emotions are in the nature of our mind? And he just very simply said, because it feels good. Anger doesn't feel good. Greed doesn't feel good. Ignorance doesn't feel good. Fear doesn't feel good. Yeah. Peace, patience, confidence, all this feels good. Why? Because it's our nature. So it's nice. Said it in a very simple way. So we can start to believe in this. What can we lose? You know? I mean, if you say, if you have cancer and you say, oh, probably not going to work, you don't even try. Could work. You know? And we have proof for that. Some people do get liberated from their cancer and then they live another number of years. Of course, they don't become eternal. But they can add some years to their life. Now, then it depends what they use it for, you know. If you just use it because you can cheat others more so you can earn more money, then that's not very good. Maybe better if you die. Yeah. It's not very good for your next rebirth, but if you really make something meaningful out of your life. And actually, I can see this also, you know, then they're sick and then they make all these promises to themselves. If I get cured, then I do this, 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 this. The moment they're cured, poof, it's back to normal life. Friend of mine who has lung cancer, he earned a lot of money. He was working for Marlboro. He has a Porsche, he has a Renault Espace, he has a sailing boat, he has a very nice house on the lake of Geneva, and he had lung cancer. And they had to get half of his lung, I think, they had to cut out. And he said, you know, I sell my car, I sell my boat. Is that? He got cured, he still has his car and his boat and everything. Yeah, habits. You see, there's not enough urgency in our mind wanting to do something. We're still enchanted by boats and Porsches and things like that. Yeah. It's all like that. He's just happy that he survived and that's it. Yeah. Then the regret maybe if he gets sick again. Why did I not do this and this and this and this? Spend more time with my family and that, you know. Okay. Good. Then, first noble truth. So the noble truth. So they're called the noble truth, right? They're not called the terrible truth, the sad truth, the destroying truth, whatever. They're called noble. They're not 100% true because they're conventional truth. Yeah. So whatever you look at, you can always say yes, but, because we have a dualistic mind. That is true. So let's let go of the yes, but. I know there's many yes, buts. conventional truths, we look quite one-sided in order to understand something. We do this out of wisdom, not out of ignorance, right? Now, okay, so the first noble truth is true sufferings or dukkha. Now, the Buddha didn't say, hey, Venerable Thekchok, you are suffering. He didn't say that. He said, there is suffering. And suffering needs to be understood. That's all. We take it personal. This is why we get so, no, it's not true. Yeah. So if you think you don't belong to this category, then just look around in the world. Whether you can see if we can recognize what the Buddha said is true. There is suffering. Can we see that there is suffering? Yes or no? Definitely. Yeah. If I would say, you know, are you suffering? He would go, not sure. Yeah. Whereas if I say, can we recognize that there is suffering? Of course we say, of course there is suffering. You know. Okay, so you made different categories with this. Actually, the word suffering is not good because it doesn't encompass the whole thing. It just tells us the first form of suffering. If you look there in the three sufferings, the suffering of pain. Sometimes it's called the suffering of suffering. This is what we understand as suffering. You understand something as suffering when you have a wish to be free from it. Then you understand that this is suffering. This is why the Buddha said there is suffering and suffering has to be understood. You have to understand this is suffering. Otherwise, why would you want to get rid of it? But because we are so used to our delusions, we don't even see them as suffering, really. Only maybe when they're very manifest. Yeah. But when they're not manifest, then, you know, it's like with the cancer. When the cancer is not manifest, then everything is okay again. We forget that the potential to have more cancer is still there. Yeah? So, suffering of pain, we understand. Yeah? Pain in the body, pain in the mind. We want to be free from it. Naturally, when you have, you know, the way I see you sitting, I mean, why are you not sitting cross-legged with, you know, with the straight back? Because it would make you much more awake. Some of you are sitting like this, but most of you are not. Why not? Why are you not sitting like this? Because of pain, exactly. So we move naturally, spontaneously. You don't have to think, oh, there's pain in the body, what shall I do now? You know? So we constantly move. Yeah, so this is why you say, I am not suffering at the moment. We all suffer of more subtle pain when we don't move, you know. So this, we don't have to go much into it. It's not desirable, right? Okay. So this is what we would call suffering. But dukkha means much more. Dukkha means nothing is able to satisfy. Dukkha means it's not, it's not genuine. It's fake. It's not satisfying. Not able to satisfy. It looks as if it's happiness, but it can't satisfy. It can't create peace, lasting peace. That is dukkha. Foam. No essence. Fake is a good word. Fake, it's not real. Now, that's the second form of suffering here. Suffering of change. This is what we call happiness. The Buddha calls it the suffering of change. This is mistaking pleasures for happiness. And this is why how we spend our whole life, which is running after pleasant feelings. And when we find them, we're very happy and we think we're very successful. And when we can't find them, we get very, very frustrated and we get very angry and then we get depressed. Or we become violent. Something like that. Because we think we don't find happiness because we don't find pleasant feelings. Why is this suffering? Why is having pleasure suffering? Now, the Buddha doesn't say pleasure is suffering. This is another thing we have to be careful. Although, after a while, if you look at it, you really understand that that's actually what he says. But you can't say that at the beginning, otherwise people completely freak out. I hear so many times, you know, people say, well, Buddhism, it's such a pessimistic philosophy, you know, like they talk about death and suffering all the time. They talk about that you're not allowed to have any pleasures. I don't know where people hear that. Nobody says that you're not allowed to have any pleasures. What is said is that pleasures lead to suffering. That's all that is being said. If you want to have pleasures, then you have to have the suffering as well. It's fine, you know, again, that's up to you. If you want to have a lot of pleasures, you also have a lot of suffering, because it goes together. Why? Think of the word suffering of change. Why are pleasures not happiness?
Because they don't last.
Exactly. Because they don't last. And it needs very little for something to destroy our pleasure. Very, very little, you know, and it needs a lot to have some pleasure. Just think, you know, you're preparing to go on a picnic, so you have to invite the right people. You have to get the right food. You have to find the right place. You have to take along the right music, you know, so lots of preparation, lots of thinking. And then you go to that place, and then a little bee is coming and stinging you. And it swells and it swells. There's a little bee, you know. You made all these preparations. For months, maybe, and you invited 200 people, wedding, yeah? You invited 200 people, all these preparations. Why? Because in order to have some happiness and some pleasure. And then this little bee comes and floof, and that's it. Finished. Or somebody, you know, like in Dharamsala, I don't know if you know, there is a picnic area. So everybody goes there because it's very beautiful. It's down at Norgulinka. So you have your party and your picnic, and then somebody comes that you don't like, you know, and then has their party right next to you. Pleasure is finished. No bee. You don't even need a bee. You don't even need any pain, you know. Pleasure finished. All those preparations for nothing. Or it starts to rain. Yeah. All these things are very fragile. The smallest condition changes. Boom. Finished. Now, going on to a deeper level, that pleasure is suffering, if you look, it's actually true. Like, you know, when we say, so we have pleasant feelings and we have painful feelings. Both of them come through conditions, like we need to give the body and the mind certain conditions in order to have pleasant or unpleasant feelings. So if it would be in the nature of the feelings to change into something different, like, you know, the feeling of pleasure changes into indifference and then actually disgust if you continue to do the same thing, right? If you continue to eat the same delicious food for 24 hours without stopping, I would guarantee you that it changes into disgust. If you don't believe me, just do it. Okay? Something that you really crave for, something that you think, wow, you know. I don't know, maybe even people that are addicted would be quite interesting to make that experiment. Maybe then the mind understands something. Not sure. I'm not sure. Maybe it's dangerous to say things like that. Not sure. So if it would be in the nature of like pleasant feelings to change into unpleasant feelings, if that would be natural and that's the way it is, then unpleasant feelings should also be able to transform into pleasure. So if you hit your hand with a hammer and you keep hitting, then that should change into a pleasant feeling at one point, but it doesn't. Pain is always pain. Or you cut, you know, put a knife into your hand and you go, it will never become pleasure. That's why pleasure is, you know. So it's very subtle suffering at the beginning. You don't feel it. But because it's suffering, because it has that contaminated seed, the more you do it, the more then it becomes. And then if somebody forces you to eat that food, after those 24 hours, for another 24 hours, becomes torture. Becomes torture. Something, so when you're logically thinking, something cannot be pleasant in the beginning and unpleasant in the end. It doesn't make sense. It's not logic. When does it at the beginning is already dukkha. Because it has it in the seed, you continue to do it. That's what dukkha means, you know. It can never satisfy. Actually, it's quite the opposite. The more you do it, the less it satisfies you. That is dukkha. That's the meaning of dukkha. And this, just to understand this, you know. Now, nobody says you can't enjoy pleasures. Nobody says that, so don't be frightened. Your chocolate cake will still be your chocolate cake and you can still eat it. But you will not be so fascinated by it anymore. You will not continue to eat that thing because you thought it should give you happiness. Dukkha is also disappointment. You see, looking for happiness in that thing and not finding it. It leaves us empty, disappointed, dissatisfied. Whatever we, you know, when we feel dissatisfied, we're looking for something to fill that hole. Right? And then we think something is lacking. Oh, if only I had that, then I would be satisfied. So we go and we consume something. But the moment we stop, we left exactly where we were at the beginning. We're not that much closer to contentment. And if you don't stop in time, even with the thing, it changes into dissatisfaction. When at the root of this desire, yeah, so this we're just looking at the symptoms. We're not looking at the causes yet. Oh wow, I have to really
hurry up here. Okay, so that's the suffering of change.
That is much more difficult to understand. To see that when you experience a moment of pleasure and your mind goes, wow, this is so great, it will leave you dissatisfied, and what this imprint does, it will force you to go look for another thing. Because you are still thinking that happiness is in the object. That is dukkha. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? But it's so liberating. If you really look what it means, it is so liberating. We can drop all the things that we think, I'm unhappy because I don't have this. It's all a lie. We'll meditate on that. To see through the lies, all the disappointments that we already had in our life. You know, but we don't stop long enough. You know, we drop something and we run to the next one and to the next one and to the next one. And this is the all-pervasive suffering. All-pervasive means it's everywhere. Meaning that if I have water here in the cup and I put a drop of ink inside, then the ink goes everywhere. It's all-pervasive. And what does it mean? It means that as long as we have this body and the mind, which are those five contaminated aggregates, it means that I carry with me 24 hours a day the potential to have the suffering of pain. I only need the conditions to change. I am like a match who at the moment is not burning, but I just need to go, whoop, and then it burns. Because why? Because the potential is there. Wherever I go, the potential is there. And not only that, because whatever feelings I experience, they are also contaminated. They are not from pure causes because they've done with delusions. Even if it's positive actions, we do them with delusions of ignorance. Yeah. So that's why they end. That's why the happy feelings always end also. And because they're contaminated, it makes me go, it forces me to go look and fight for more pleasant feelings, I create more negativities, I create more suffering. Because this body and this mind is in the nature of suffering, of course, the result that comes from it can also only be in the nature of suffering. It's law of cause and effect. Yeah. This body and mind that I have comes from contaminated causes, which is delusions. Yeah. Therefore, it also creates more suffering in the future. And this, to really be disturbed by this, this is very difficult to understand. So now you see why the Buddha started like this with the first noble truth, everything is the nature of suffering, or there is suffering, so that we understand the subtle sufferings. The gross sufferings we don't need to, we understood, but we don't need to be so proud about this. I mean, even animals understand those. Yeah. So this is what we have to understand. And if we want to have lasting happiness, we have to be free of all three. Just being free from the suffering of pain, we all know that's not enough. You know? If we don't have any pain in the body and in the mind, there's still this restlessness looking for something. Then we go and have some pleasure. And we think that is happiness. It seems not to be enough. Because why? Because we need to stop. And the moment we stop, then the itch comes again. Actually, this is all thing, you know. This craving for pleasant feelings is like having something that makes us itch. Yeah, our desire is like an itch. Now, because we always had desire, we are like somebody who is born with itching parts in their body. They don't know that we can be without itching. Yeah. So then, of course, scratching is very pleasant. Is happiness when you scratch, if you have an itch. But if you've had a body before that was without this itching part, okay? And then you have something that itches and then you scratch and this is pleasure, still you hope for this itch to go because you see, even though it's pleasant to scratch, but it's much better not to have the itch. But because we always had delusions, we don't know how it is to be without delusions. That's why we're so fascinated with the pleasures. Which is scratch all the time because it's so pleasant. Somebody comes and says, you know, I can give you something to get rid of that, of the itch. No, I like the pleasure when I scratch. This is us. And the Buddha is telling us how to get rid of the itch. We say, no. I really like the pleasure from scratching. And at the moment, I really have two big bites from I don't know what, you know, and is really itchy. So even though when they're gone, I don't have the pleasure of scratching anymore, but I'm waiting for them to go. Only when you are free from those things, you understand what it means having them. This is why the Buddha said, you know, the Buddha has freed himself from the dukkha. This is why now he can explain to us, hey, look, you don't understand this is suffering. You think it's happiness, but as a matter of fact, it is suffering. And you can only understand that when you're free from it. Okay? All pervasive. So we have to get rid of all three sufferings in order to be free from dukkha, in order to have lasting happiness. So the goal in Buddhism is to have lasting happiness. This is why we talk so much about suffering. And why we talk so much about death and dying is that at the moment we have perfect conditions to do something. So when we think that we're not going to live forever, then we do something now. Hopefully. Okay, and then there's the two other lists, the six sufferings and the eight sufferings. They're quite easy to understand. So again, it's like, this I could clearly state, you have all of those. And if you say, no, that's not true, maybe not at the moment, but we can all relate to those. Yeah. Uncertainty. There's nothing we can be sure of. Why? Because everything comes together through causes and conditions. That means everything is impermanent. That means if any of the conditions are missing, that means if the cause is not strong enough, things don't come together or fall apart very, very quickly. Everything is subject to change, yeah? Out of that, because we grasp, we want them to last, come fear and hope. If we would understand impermanence, we wouldn't have any fears. And if we don't have any fears, we don't have any hopes. No, it's the other way around, sorry. If we don't have any hopes, we don't have any fears. Now, again, don't jump to the conclusion Buddhists are like vegetables, completely hopeless people. Oh, there's no hope. I'm not doing anything. It's not like this. Yeah? Not like that. But this silly hope that when it doesn't happen, and then you're completely destroyed because you didn't understand the nature of things, you know. Or also hope is very blocking, you know. We think hope is enough. We just sit and hope and hope and hope and hope for the best and then that's it, you know. If you don't create the causes, if you don't create the negative causes, you will not have to undergo gross negative emotions or suffering. And if you haven't created the positive causes to have pleasant feelings, you will not have pleasant feelings. There's hopes and fears, they don't have any influence on you suffering or being happy. They're not the cause, you know. They just make us very restless. So it's to go beyond hopes and fears. But still, at the beginning, we need to have the fear of being afraid of the suffering. Otherwise, we will not go beyond the fear. Yeah, again, so one needs to go in steps there. Uncertainty. At every moment, just like this, we can lose everything we cherish. And then we try to protect ourselves. And it works to some extent, but it never works completely. You know, I know people, they have very big walls around their houses. They have very big houses. They have cameras. They have dogs. They even have guards who guard their house. They're sitting inside this fortress, being completely depressed. Just having all this is not going to make you have no guarantee that your mind will be happy with whatever. They have a nice husband, they have nice kids, they have a healthy body, they look good. Completely depressed. Oh, I'm not saying everybody, yeah? Just saying some people. And I know some of them, so I was living in a house like this. They asked me to come and house sit because they were going on holiday, you know. So they couldn't leave the house alone because somebody needed to be there to switch on the light, switch it off, and this and that, to live there. So the thieves would see that somebody is there. Oh, gosh, it was so boring. At the beginning, it was kind of interesting to get, you know, all the gadgets, and you'd switch for this and switch for that. And after 3 days, I got completely bored in this house, even though there was a swimming pool and a sauna and a fitness room and this. The lake was like 10 minutes away by bike, and then I went if I went for a swim, I went to the lake. So it's so boring to swim in your own swimming pool, you know. Anyway. I enjoyed it, but not for long, really. And I wasn't, I thought, wow, it would be nice to invite my friends, but I didn't dare because I thought they probably wouldn't like it. So I didn't. So like that. Unsatisfactoriness, this is that one now. No matter how much we have, we will never be satisfied. Satisfaction means you say, your mind can clearly state, I've seen enough beautiful forms, I've seen enough, I've had enough delicious tastes, I had enough melodious sounds, I had enough nice touches, and I had enough good smells. I don't need them anymore. I don't need to chase after them. I'm satisfied. That is satisfaction. But we consume one thing, and what do? Then we get bored with it, and then we jump to the next. And we mistake boredom for satisfaction. We think we're satisfied. Satisfaction means you don't need anything more. If they come your way, that's fine. You enjoy them. This is what I'm saying. Nobody says you shouldn't enjoy. Yeah? But you're not producing them. Look how much effort goes into producing those five sense objects. Culture. We call it culture. We make everything beautiful, refined, and museums, and this and that, and, you know, to have happiness. We create beauty to be happy. Then the beauty is real. We created it. But we completely fall in love with it. There's some inherent beauty in there. We created it. How can there be inherent beauty in some paint when it touched the brush and then is put on a piece of cloth? I know that's talking very harshly. But you can enjoy paintings, by the way, when you understand that's not the cause for your happiness. You have a toothache. You don't want to look at that painting. If that painting or statue or whatever has inherent beauty, it should be able to help you when you have a toothache and to make you happy, also when you have a toothache. Pleasures only work when you are well. And then why do you need all the pleasures if you're well anyway? Unsatisfactoriness. This is why we make so much progress. This is why the world looks the way it looks, because we're unsatisfied. And there is no end to it, because we could always be more comfortable. And we could always be richer and always have faster cars and smaller MP3 players and I don't know what, you know what I'm talking about. Okay? So this too, I think that's not exclusive to Buddhists. Now the next two, if you don't believe in rebirth, then you can say, oh, that's only for Buddhists. So we have to be reborn again and again and again and again. And when we are reborn again and again and again and again, of course we have to die again and again and again and again. And dying is not a pleasant thing, I'm sorry to say. There is a lot of suffering around death. Why? One of the big reasons, I think, is because we struggle so much in our life to build something up. For what? To leave it all behind. That's why it's not pleasant. It's like cooking a very delicious meal and then we have to throw it away. Can't take it with us. When you suffer, that's why we suffer at the time of death. Because everything we build up, we have to leave it behind. I mean, worldly stuff. I'm not talking about mental realizations. Those you take with you. Your karmic imprints you take with you. The potentials of your actions you take with you. But all the things that we usually work for, fame, renown, comfort, gain. Those are the four things that we work for. Then when we have any of those, we say successful life. None of those can give you a guarantee of happiness. Otherwise, everybody who is famous would be happy. Otherwise, everybody who is known would be happy. Otherwise, comfort would make us happy. It doesn't. Because if it would make us happy, we'd need more of it. Yeah. And also otherwise, gain would make us happy. It doesn't. It makes us happy for a short moment. That's true. But not for very long. So as we go along, you know, so we're reborn. And then we struggle. We struggle to grow up, to learn all those things. It's difficult to be a kid. I mean, if you look at the children today, there is so much pressure on them. So much pressure. I mean, no wonder they're kind of already needing psychiatrists. The age of 8. Even smaller, I think. Yeah, I mean, it's really sad. And it's not really addressed, that problem. You know, we give them to the psychologists. Let them fix their minds. Wow. And we call ourselves the first world, you know. We advanced. Look at the state of our minds with all our advancements. Jesus. Look at our children. There's hardly any children who are not ADD, ADS, AD, I don't know what, PPZ, I don't know all those names, you know, because I don't have any children. Hardly anybody doesn't have some disorder. I think we also had those disorders, by the way, yeah? It's not that we were that much better, but it wasn't so evident because we had much less stress. I mean, when I was young, you know, the word stress, we didn't really know what that was. Mental breakdown, depression. You know, if somebody would say, oh, this one is, you know, this one has depression, we go, wow, really? Well, you know, it was like a sensation almost, you know, 50 years ago. I mean, where I'm from, Switzerland. So if somebody had a mental breakdown, they quit their job, they went into hospital, and it was a big thing. These days, mental breakdowns, it's like we can all relate to those words. Stress, mental breakdowns, depression. We all know from personal experience what it is. And we keep going in the same direction. Because why? Because we put all our hopes into those things. Gain, comfort, renown, fame. Worldly concerns. We think, I would be happier if I had more of this. And then we get more and more and more and more. And the mind remains the same. So this is, and then we struggle. We get something, you know. We're very happy that we got something. And then we die, we have to leave it behind. And actually, even before you die, you know, this is the next one. We're constantly going from high to low. Even before you die, you plunge, you know. All your intellectual knowledge disappears, your beauty disappears, your money, because you can't accumulate more, starts to disappear. People get very frightened. They don't have enough before they die. You know, when you see old people counting their money very desperately like this, it's not a very nice sight, actually. You know, they get very miserly and very frightened like this because they're used to new money coming in, so they're very frightened that they won't have enough before they die, and so on. So we have to leave everything behind. Everything we put our hopes on, yeah, we have to leave behind. For what? To start all over again in next life. This we call the purpose of our life. It's like building very elaborate sandcastles next to the ocean, you know, spending lots of time, the whole day just building the sandcastle. In the evening, the tide comes and whoop, and it's all gone. Then tomorrow we start again. And then again, and again, and again, and again. Okay? Now don't get too depressed here. Okay? It's not the terrible truth. It's the noble truth. We're just describing the symptoms. And then we have three other truths where we say how to get, what to do about this. But first, and it's very skillful to how the Buddha did it. He didn't say, these are the causes and this create the sufferings. We first need to understand, actually it's quite good if you are a bit depressed now, by the way, because that will make you look, you know. If we're not depressed, depression is actually quite a good thing because it shows us something is wrong. If you just, la, da, 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 everything is okay, then nothing will ever change. So don't be so disturbed about your depression. It's a good thing. It's a sign something is wrong. So constantly going from high to low. You know, as they say, all collections end up running out. Every meeting ends in separation. Every living ends in death. Life after life after life after life after life. And we just continue. And it's not satisfying. And as we go along, we endure actually quite a lot of the suffering of pain. Not just the suffering of dissatisfaction and things like that. Yeah. And then the last one is that we're being completely alone in this whole thing, what we call life. The most difficult moments that we have in our life, we understand how alone we are. That we are the only ones who can fix these problems. We have to learn to rely upon ourselves. Of course, we can go to friends and family and all this. But when we die, they can't come with us. If you have only relied on your friends and family to solve your problems and to make you feel good about yourself, your death will be terrible because you don't know how to rely upon yourself. Then you will feel the loneliness as suffering. When we're born alone. Don't know, you know. Baby doesn't know what's going on. Terrible experience. I mean, just look how we come into this world. People say it's a happy event. I'm talking about birth itself. Excuse me. The mother screams, the baby screams, there's blood everywhere. You know, I mean, what's so happy about this? It's very violent, huh?
The father faints.
The father faints. And complains. Suffers. Yeah? Okay. So those are the six, being completely alone in that process. So then the eight sufferings there are quite easy to understand. Also, some of them are a little bit repeating themselves. Birth, as I just said, the act of birth is suffering. Can we agree to that? I think so, yeah. Sickness has nothing satisfying. Now, of course, people say, oh, you can learn a lot from it. Yes, of course. But the sickness itself, when you wake up in the morning and you have a terrible headache or a little headache and a stuffed nose, and you say, oh, great, I can learn something from that. It's not satisfying. And you see, our body is such a fragile machine. And it needs so many conditions to keep it healthy. It needs so little to make it sick. And then we're surprised when we're sick and we're not surprised when we're healthy. We should turn this whole thing around. We should be surprised and very happy when we're not waking up sick. So at least we enjoy being healthy. We don't even enjoy being healthy. We only are miserable when we're not healthy. If we could see how many conditions this body needs, you know. This morning I had a spontaneous thought kind of coming up and it made me so happy. I said, wow, I can walk. It's a miracle that we can walk. It needs so little to destroy that we can walk. You trip, you fall down the steps, you break your spine. Boom, finished. Our senses are very fragile. A big bang, your ear's gone, you know. Sometimes the retina in your eye can detach itself. You make a little bit of an effort. And if you don't have somebody who lasers it immediately, the eyesight of that eye is gone. If your nerves in your tongue and in your nose disappear, that's it. Very fragile. And we never wonder at this miracle. We take it for granted. And then when it's not there anymore, then we get depressed. Okay. Sickness. Old age. Old age is fun? What do you think? Huh? What do you think? Well, you don't know yet. What about those older ones? Old age is fun. You need glasses because you can't read anymore without glasses. You need hearing aids because you can't hear anymore. You need somebody who pulls you up when you want to get up. You need somebody who helps you get down when you want to get down. You need somebody to go down the stairs. Yeah, exactly, the teeth. Yeah, you want to eat all this food, then you have artificial teeth. You laugh, boom, they fall down. You know, it's so embarrassing. Yeah? The wrinkles. How much money is made because people don't want to acknowledge their old age? And because it is unpleasant. Yeah? It is unpleasant. It's in the nature to get old. It's okay to be old, but we're not even allowed to use that word anymore. You know, you wouldn't tell somebody, oh, wow, you're old. You wouldn't say that. Not even a group of people we call, you know, it's not even directed at somebody. We call them old people. We call them elderly people. They're old. So what? You know? We will all get there. You'll all get there if you don't die young. And then you'll see. It's nothing pleasant in old age. It's really difficult. I can't remember who said, old age is not for sissies. You know? Everything that you experience as difficult as a young person is like triple or even more difficult when you're old. The only good thing is that you got used to the pain. That's why you can bear it better, you know.
But everything becomes more complicated and more difficult. You need so many more conditions to be comfortable and happy and healthy. I mean, look at the amount of medicines that people swallow over 50. Even they're not sick, you know. Maybe even younger, I don't know. How many of you swallow regular things every day? Look at us, the ones who raise their hands. Yeah? You'll be in the same spot at one point. Even I was talking like vitamins and things like that. Glucosamine, vitamins, omega-3 omega, what are they called? Don't know. Whatever. We try to, you know, it's okay if you try to hold up the process, but it won't work. No matter what it says on the box. Old age. Death again, it's not really that pleasant. If it's not unpleasant for you, then it's unpleasant for the ones who love you. Yeah? Death is not a happy event. I'm sorry. Like, then for others is having what we don't want. Being together, being in contact, what we don't want is suffering. I think we can admit that. Not having what we want or losing what we cherish is suffering. Of course, you know. We don't notice it. We only notice it when it happens. This is why we'll do the meditation on it, and I'll ask you to remember a few things. And not finding what we want is frustrating. Okay, that's it. Those are those three lists. Can we agree that there is, those things do exist in our life? Are they satisfying? Are you happy when you get in contact with them? Are you happy when you experience them on directly? Any of those things? You don't know? Come on. Are you happy?
No.
No. Do you want to get rid of it? Okay, then you have to come back this afternoon. Because then we talk about the causes. So that's it. It was just, you know, this first noble truth. It's not to make you depressed. It's just for us to admit, to have the courage to admit, yes, it's true, they are there and they're not satisfying. And that's it. Otherwise, we'll never generate renunciation. So we're not renouncing just the pleasures, like running after the pleasures. When you renounce running after the pleasures, you renounce the suffering. It's as simple as that, you know. That's what you're renouncing. You renounce the suffering of losing them. You renounce the suffering of them becoming boring. You renounce the suffering of having to work so hard because all these things that we call pleasures, unfortunately, they're quite expensive. That's what you're renouncing. And you become free. Okay. Good, so now I went 15 minutes over, I think. So when is the meditation? 11:30, I think. So we have 15 minutes break. Is that enough? Yeah. And then we do a short meditation, half an hour meditation. Yeah.
Maybe the suffering is the one which is not written here. There are seven here.
No, there's seven here. Yeah, I forgot one. That's me. I'm not very thorough, I have to say. I would need an editor when I do things like this, I think. Very good observation. The aged one is a little bit like the all pervasive one, having those five contaminated aggregates, which, whether we want or not, create more suffering for the future. Yeah, sorry. Very good that you saw that. I'm terrible. I shouldn't teach those things. No, that's suffering of old age also. It's terrible, I tell you. Like, when you forget people's names, just like this, you know, and they feel hurt, as if I do it on purpose, you know. Or, like yesterday, I was supposed to take that box with the statues. Completely gone from my mind. Completely disappeared. It was like absolutely oblivious that I have to take this box with the statues. And that's quite frightening. Especially when you're so much in control of your brain, as I was, you know, remembering everything and knowing everything and blah, blah. And all of a sudden, poof, it goes. That is suffering. It's frightening. Because, of course, you know, you forget a box, that's the first, I'm getting Alzheimer's. Yeah?